Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. This Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You could use a shortwave radio with the schedule of English language broadcasts, but it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from NHK Japan, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, France 24, and Radio Havana, Cuba. We will begin with NHK World Radio Japan. UNICEF surveyed youth in 36 nations on physical and mental health as well as skills. China has offered Latin American countries support for development in infrastructure, agriculture, and energy. The head of the World Trade Organization has welcomed the economic relaxing between the U.S. and China, but says that Trump's tariffs remain a global economic threat. NHK Japan.
A new report from UNICEF puts Japan top of the class for children's physical health, but for mental well-being, the country languishes near the bottom. The survey covers 36 nations from the European Union and the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. It's the first in 5 years. There are 3 categories: physical health, mental health, and skills. The Netherlands ranks first overall, followed by Denmark and France. And Japan is 14th, up from 20th out of 38 last time around. The country excels in terms of physical health, with fewer overweight children and a lower mortality rate. Japan ranks 12th in the category that measures academic and social skills, but a lowly 32nd for mental well-being. The percentage of respondents in Japan who are satisfied with their lives increased, but the country's adolescent suicide rate is the 4th highest. Chinese President Xi Jinping has offered Latin American and Caribbean nations over $9 billion in fresh credit to support development in the region. Xi's announcement came in his speech at a ministerial meeting in Beijing of a forum bringing together China and Latin American and Caribbean states. He said trade between China and Latin American countries had risen 40-fold since the start of the century to exceed $500 billion for the first time last year.
In the face of seething undercurrents of pure political and bloc confrontation and the surging tide of unilateralism and protectionism, China would like to join hands with Latin countries to initiate 5 programs to seek development and prosperity and build up the China-Latin America community of shared future.
Xi pledged to strengthen cooperation in various fields, including infrastructure, agriculture, and energy. The head of the World Trade Organization has welcomed moves by the U.S. and China to cool their tariff war. But she says global economic growth continues to be under threat from Washington's stance on trade. WTO Director General Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala spoke to NHK in Tokyo on Wednesday. She expressed concern that Trump's tariffs could lead to a worldwide decoupling of economic links.
Such a decoupling could lead to fragmentation of world trade, which would have quite severe consequences for global growth of trade. It is very, very clear that if the world trading system fragments into 2 blocks, we have actually modeled this and we would lose up to 7% of global GDP in the longer term.
Okonjo-Iweala reiterated the importance of free trade. She said globalization has helped lift many countries into prosperity. But at the same time, she said, the WTO faces challenges such as the uneven distribution of wealth and widening disparity. She advocates the concept of reglobalization to address the issues. This involves spreading out supply chains to support countries and areas that have yet to benefit from global developments.
Let's deconcentrate supply chains to those parts of rich countries that didn't benefit and to poor countries. And I think at the same time, we kill two birds with one stone. We build a more resilient world system, and we also include those left behind.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan on shortwave. They're heard at 10 p.m. at 13710 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp. All the times I announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. NHK Japan is also available at most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. Next, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. The first white South Africans granted refugee status in the U.S. have arrived to people protesting. The Trump administration says the Afrikaners are victims of a genocide. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
The first white South Africans granted refugee status by the Trump administration have traveled to the country. The group of 49 accepted an offer of resettlement and have arrived at Dulles Airport outside Washington. President Trump claims the white minority in South Africa suffers racial discrimination, an accusation dismissed by its government.
There is no persecution of white African or South Africans in South Africa. This has been proven by a number of statistics in our country, including the police reports, which don't back that assertion of persecution of white South Africans on the basis of their race. The crime that we have in South Africa affects everyone, irrespective of race and irrespective of gender.
Our correspondent Benjamin Alvarez was at Dulles Airport and sent this report.
The Trump administration says there are victims of a genocide, something that the government in South Africa strongly rejects. 49 people arrived here on a U.S. government chartered plane, were greeted by State Department officials before being sent to other cities in the United States. It's not clear yet how many will follow, as thousands have applied to be granted asylum in the United States. They have been lobbying the Trump administration since the first presidency, asking for more help and support from Washington. We spoke to some protesters who gathered here at the departure hall, saying that they want, what they say, real refugees be allowed in this country from other places like Afghanistan, like Iraq, or several African countries, as the Trump administration virtually shut down their refugee program. And they accused that the white people from South Africa that arrived here earlier today on this plane are being favored compared to other refugees who have been trying to come to the U.S. for several months, if not years.
Those reports were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary. Also most podcast sites. On to France 24. Heavy Israeli bombing in various areas of Palestine this Wednesday and Thursday led to widespread coverage and criticism in Europe. No aid has entered the Gaza Strip in nearly 3 months. An interview with Oliver McTernan, director of Forward Thinking, an NGO working for 2 decades to promote a peace process in the Middle East. He says there is more destruction in Gaza than he has ever seen. He discusses the influence Trump has on Netanyahu and that the Arab states cannot normalize relations with Israel as long as the occupation of Palestine continues. He says that the Netanyahu government has weaponized anti-Semitism, leaving people afraid to speak the truth. France 24.
In Khan Yunis, distraught families mourn their relatives at Nasser Hospital, killed by Israeli airstrikes. Mariam Ashour lost her sister.
These are civilians. They have nothing to do with any political party. They worked only for God. From the first day of the war, she was volunteering for UNRWA, offering psychological support services and organising parties for the children to help with their morale.
Israel targeted Khan Yunis, Jabalia, Deir el-Bala and Gaza City on Thursday morning. Rubble fell on the home of this Deir el-Bala resident when his neighbour's house was bombed.
As you can see, the house was completely destroyed and a family had been wiped off the map. Only the husband survived. The whole area has been seriously damaged. We found several bodies.
Wednesday too saw extensive strikes after Israel warned of an escalation of force earlier this week and a renewed ground offensive. This amid a critical aid shortage. World Food Programme warehouses in Gaza stand empty, with bread-making facilities at a standstill. Warehouses outside of its borders, meanwhile, stand full of humanitarian supplies, but no aid has entered the strip in nearly 3 months.
Well, for more on this, let's bring Oliver McTernan on the program. He is the director of Forward Thinking, which is an independent NGO working to promote an inclusive peace process in the Middle East, amongst other dialogue-based objectives. Let's start, obviously, with the humanitarian situation. We got a picture of the latest in that report there. You've been covering this conflict for a long time. Is this the worst that you've seen in Gaza in recent memory?
Yes, all means it is the very worst. I think we're faced with an incredible, inhuman situation.
We've seen international leaders kind of step up criticisms of Israel over the past week or so, including from places where officials have been much more muted in their condemnation thus far. I mean, how do you explain that? Why now? What has changed?
Well, I hope seeing the horrendous pictures that are coming from Gaza on a daily basis, this isn't disinformation. These are coming from ordinary people who have cameras and are able to can record what's happening on the ground and to broadcast it without any interference. I think the shock and the horror of seeing those pictures is gradually penetrating. But let's face it, it's 19 months now the people of Gaza have been suffering in this inhumane way. So I think it's about time that the political leaders find the moral courage to call out what is clearly wrong and immoral.
To what extent do you think the return of Donald Trump to the White House has emboldened Netanyahu? I mean, do you think that there is a link between Donald Trump's presidency and the kind of catastrophic situation that we see today? And kind of as a follow-up to that is that there is now actually speculation that there's been some tension between Netanyahu and Donald Trump, especially as, you know, Trump is not stopping in Israel on this trip to the Middle East. Netanyahu was reportedly not a part of that hostage deal. So what do you make of the evolution of their relationship since Donald Trump's return?
Well, you may recall Biden at the beginning of this war saying there were no red lines between America and Israel. I think Trump's election for Netanyahu was seen as not just no red lines, but a real endorsement of the policies that he wanted to pursue. Now, I think the indication now is that actually Trump may be realizing that Netanyahu is leading us into a situation that will have consequences for decades to come. The meaningless daily killing that is going on at present, I fear, are sowing the seeds for an endless conflict. So if Trump realizes that he is the only one, as the former Israeli Prime Minister said earlier today in an interview, he is the only one who can say, stop, enough, you've got to finish this madness. And I fully agree with Olmert's analysis that if Trump acts in this way, and I would think what we're hearing from his visit to Saudi Arabia and now in Doha and then going on to the Emirates, I think he's getting a very clear message that the Arab and Gulf states cannot normalize with Israel so long as occupation continues and there isn't the recognition and establishment of a Palestinian state. That's the only way that will bring security to Israel that it requires.
Listening to you, it kind of begs the question as far as leaders in the Middle East are concerned, in any case, whether or not the situation in Gaza has fallen on the back burner, especially because, you know, we've seen numerous regional leaders normalize ties with Israel in recent years, notably since 2020. On top of that, I mean, we just saw Donald Trump has already visited two countries, Saudi Arabia and Qatar. He's mostly talked about business in Qatar, at least today. There have been no significant public addressing of the situation in Gaza, neither from the Arab leaders themselves nor for Donald Trump. So do you think it's still at the top of their agenda?
I don't think it's at the top of their agenda, and that is the problem. I think you're right that it has been on the back burner for some time. I find it awful when I see the daily pictures that I get from Gaza of the bodies of children and mothers strewn across the streets, that hasn't shocked our Western media and it hasn't grabbed the headlines. I fear for too long now we've seen the usual cycle from empathy into apathy. And the empathy-apathy cycle comes because I think ordinary people in Europe are appalled by what's going on, but they feel helpless. And because they feel helpless or have no influence on the political leadership, what happens then? They switch off. And then the media, I fear, picks that mood up and then prioritizes other events.
As someone that's been covering this, you know, this conflict for so long, why do you think the international community has been so unwilling to sanction Netanyahu's government and to muster? I mean, why even use the word courage when you talk about international leaders, how they should be reacting to what's happening? Why is that something that, in your view, requires so much courage on the international stage today?
Well, I think one of the major problems is that the Netanyahu government has weaponized anti-Semitism, and people are deeply afraid that if they speak truth, if they call out what is wrong, that they will be automatically accused of being anti-Semitic. I always quote Lapid when he was the foreign minister of Israel and was speaking at the UN conference, I think it was in 22, when he talked about anti-Semitism in terms of speaking hatred of Jews, and everyone would wholeheartedly endorse that. But then he went on to say, to treat Israel differently from any other country is anti-Semitic. And that is precisely, I fear, what we have been doing over the last 19 months. Biden, at the beginning of this war, warned them not to make the same mistakes as America made after 9/11, realizing America was traumatized. Israel has been traumatized, and we've allowed it to act in a traumatized way without pointing out the immediate and long-term consequences of such actions. I do fear that what we're witnessing now is not strengthening or protecting the security of Israel. In fact, it's putting it at risk.
Oliver McTiernan, we just have about 30 seconds left, but I just have one final question for you. I mean, this is clearly something that is, you know, seeing suffering is clearly not going to be enough for international leaders for them to put more pressure on Netanyahu. So what leverage, as this visit in the Middle East continues for Donald Trump, what leverage might Gulf countries have with the United States to put pressure on Israel?
Well, as we said, Trump was the key person in telling Netanyahu, stop, enough, and in getting recognition of a Palestinian state, an end of occupation. I think the Saudi leadership in particular are key to ensuring that Trump takes that line of action. If the Saudis hold firm and say, look, there is no normalization unless we have end of occupation, a Palestinian state, then as a region we can work for the good of each other. I think that is the only way forward, and it's MBS has, like Donald Trump, the power to act now. We're at a historic moment where we could see historic change in the region. But to do that, I think we'll need moral and political courage.
Oliver McTernan, director of the NGO Forward Thinking, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
That interview is from France 24. France 24 may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English, also most podcast sites. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this program, like a listener in Whitethorn, California, and a subscriber in Willits did this week, there's a link for online donations available at my website, outfarpress.com, or you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Many, many thanks to everyone who's ever helped keep this freely distributed show on the airwaves. Please, help if you can. And if you're listening on a public radio station, please help support them as well. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. There's a new documentary film called Who Killed Shireen about the Israeli soldier's murder of the Palestinian-American reporter Shireen Abu Akleh. The Lancet Medical Journal from London has published a report saying the number of people killed in Palestine is likely over 100,000. Radio Havana, Cuba.
A new documentary film has shed light on how the administration of the United States President Joseph Biden responded to the killing of Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, suggesting that Washington had evidence indicating that her shooting death was intentional. An Israeli sniper fatally shot Abu Akleh nearly 3 years ago while she was reporting from the Jenin refugee camp in the Israeli-occupied West Bank on May the 11th, 2022. A new film, a 40-minute investigative documentary from the Washington, D.C.-based media group Zedkill, was released on Thursday just ahead of the anniversary of her death. Under the title, Who Killed Shireen?, the documentary explores not only who pulled the trigger, but why justice has been so elusive in Abu Akleh's case. It also offers the clearest picture yet of the Biden administration's political maneuvering as public pressure mounted for accountability. The journalist was a U.S. citizen. During her final reporting assignment, she wore both a helmet and a blue vest, clearly labeled with the word press, to indicate her status as a journalist. In the aftermath of her killing, the Joe Biden administration faced pressure to investigate the circumstances of her death and whether the shooting was intentional. But while the administration initially called for an independent, credible investigation, it shifted its stance after the months progressed. It walked back calls for the killer to be prosecuted, eventually described the shooting as a result of tragic circumstances. It also eased its scrutiny of the Israeli military, calling for accountability only in the form of a review of its rules of engagement. The documentary, Who Killed Shireen?, features interviews from former Washington insiders about why Joe Biden made such a pivot. Its most damaging testimony comes from an anonymous official who spoke with his face and voice obscured. In the film, the official claims the evidence available to the Biden administration indicated that Abu Akleh's death was an intentional killing. He said that the assessment was based on visual capabilities of that day and the distance between Israeli snipers and the journalists who were shot. Another journalist, Ali al-Samoudi, was also wounded at the same time, though he survived his gunshot. Whether or not they knew it was her or cannot be very well debated. They knew who she was. They absolutely had known that she was a media person and a non-combatant. The official acknowledged the shift in the Biden administration's position from viewing the shooting as an intentional killing to describing it as a tragic accident. He linked that about-face to the historically close ties of Washington and Tel Aviv. A new study suggests that up to 109,000 people have been killed since the start of Israel's genocidal campaign across the besieged Gaza Strip in October of 2023. The study, published in the London-based The Lancet, reviewed hospital records, online civilian death submissions, and an independently compiled list based on social media, obituaries, and death announcements. By comparing the three lists, researchers concluded that the number of people killed in Gaza was quite much higher than the figure reported by authorities in the besieged Palestinian region, which they are saying now is about 53,000. We're looking now at over 100,000. The study estimates that the real death toll could be 46 to 107% higher than reported, meaning that between 77,000 and 109,000 people have died in Israeli attacks. Based on current numbers, that is equivalent to between 5 and 6% of Gaza's pre-war population. Israel describes all of those killed in Gaza as fighters, even though most of them were women and children. The latest figures by the Gaza Health Ministry stated that Israel has killed 52,787 Palestinians in Gaza, stressing that it could not reach a register of many victims who are either under the rubble or in areas that Israel's military continues to target and unable to get to them. The ministry's data, compiled from hospitals across Gaza and an online form that allows families to report killings, often in areas inaccessible due to continued Israeli attacks. The findings cast new light on the underreported deaths in Gaza, especially amid the ongoing destruction of health infrastructure and communication networks that further hinder accurate information. Additionally, deaths caused by the war indirectly, such as those from the collapse of medical services, may not be fully represented. A definitive count of how many people have died in this war will be difficult even after it ends, according to researchers, and that may still be a long, long way off. Israel's relentless air and artillery strikes keep killing more civilians in Gaza as the regime presses ahead with its genocidal war on Gaza. 19 months into Israel's genocidal war, the regime keeps hammering the devastated Gaza Strip, leaving a trail of death and destruction behind. Figures show that 90% of Gaza's current population of 2,100,000 people have been displaced, lacking access to sufficient water, food, life-saving medical services, education, and livelihoods.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140 and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Daylight Saving Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You do have to look harder these days because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online support. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 29th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report was produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm still recuperating from a spinal injury and staying in a house connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.